Now at 6:30, Russell Davis continues his survey of the story of radio comedy by venturing into the 1950s, a period of great change.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present a radio program in English. From time to time, actors will be heard. The author has fled the country.
The curious start of an odd experiment. The program in English brings an echo of Gilly Potter, but you recognize the actors as belonging to a younger generation than that, a more worried generation, too.
1954. A world overshadowed with doubts, fears, uncertainty. Of Indochina, the Suez, Cyprus, East and West German strikes, the H-bomb explosion, and yet to come, the unbelievable power of the cobalt bomb. But our own governors are not unaware of these dangers. At this moment, the House of Commons are debating serious matters.
Darling, they're ruining St. Martin.
There are far too many darlings in the Trafalgar Square.
We must get rid of these disgusting creatures. We must.
Well said.
Well, was it a goon show or not? The goonologists are probably still debating the matter. The starlings had the goon cast, but the sometimes serious satirical tone had more to do with the real-life preoccupations of scriptwriter Spike Milligan, who couldn't bear to see effort expended over the extermination of supposedly pestilential bird life when all around the political world seemed to be falling apart. The show got the goons, not for the first time, into trouble, and later we'll hear a little of what caused offence. But meanwhile, another of the problems involved in it was its experimental form. Listeners have already grown used to laughter and giggling from the audience and the performers as the oral washing line on which the goon show was hung. But here, the background was as bare and audienceless as a radio play. In the early 50s, as a matter of fact, a general disgust with audience shows was in the air. In his popular show, Just Fancy, Eric Barker was one of the ones to voice it.
Ladies and gentlemen, may we take this opportunity of welcoming you once more to this program. You see, no audience roar to persuade you that it's going to be really something. No orchestra, passion, marvelous, and brass to make further conversation on your part impracticable. We just depend on your goodwill to get our message across. Of course, goodwill can be a two-edged sword. Occasionally, we hear the variety show that does not retain the goodwill with which it starts, so that the artist has to leap in and supply his own laugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Tommy Comforth Show! And here he is, the boy who counts the light, the guy England can do without, every woman's idea of what a man shouldn't be, the one and only Tommy Comforth!
Hello, boys and girls. Well, how are you? Everybody all right, eh? I'm so happy because I'm not mean, you know. Oh, no, I was watching the pipe cleaners last night. By the way, it's a very funny woman, the wife, you know. Writes poems as the wife. Yes, writes poems. Here's one. I love her hubby very much. He loves the woman and the jelly. But I never give him rhubarb because he suffers with his headache. By the way,
it seems there was a widespread feeling that now the war was receding into memory, stand-up comedy was trying too hard. The Stephen Potter-Joyce Grenfell gang thought so too, in their third programme expose, How to Broadcast.
Our next guest in Fits and Starts will be introduced to you by our old friend Bill Swinton, if I can get him out of the bass drum.
Bill? Hey, Bill, come over here.
Oh, me? I'm far from fit.
You'll feel all right when I tell you who our next guest is.
Now, picture the Eiffel Tower.
Aye.
Picture a gay little cafe on the corner.
Aye, I feel better already. I'm feeling fit.
The essence of that lovely city of laughter is the chicest little Parisian of them all.
Oh, la la, lead me to him.
Okay. Bill, this is Colette Neal. Colette, this is Bill.
Hello, Bill.
Hello, Colette.
What does it mean?
Why couldn't I keep my big mouth shut? Well, it means you're a bit of all right, Colette, and third okay.
I think you are. Bill?
Well, I'm far from fit.
Very funny.
No, only gets worse.
I was walking along the street just now, and I saw a man I know. His name was Smithers Pomfret, and he was carrying a zither. Well, he was the third man I've seen with a zither in a week. Oh, well, that goes better with film fat. He said, how about a quick supper? So, of course, I said, suits me to a T. Well, that's what it says in the script. No wonder the script writer is starving. Well, where was it? Oh, yes. I'll get him a cup of tea with a sailor.
And that failed gangster was Mr. Roy Plumley in his satirical days. Imitators and impersonators were still plying their specialized trade, and as usual, they're harder to judge, since their victims and targets are only dimly remembered. But there's no doubt, judging by the response, that a young variety bandbox recruit called Peter Sellers was getting it right.
This is David Southwood, and as usual, my seat is in the circle, but there's a little boy sitting next to me who keeps shouting. I say, Sonny, would you mind being quiet, please?
I beg your pardon. I'm Southwood, not Stuffy.
You may be Southwood, but you're still Corbin. Here, can you play Knock Knock?
Yes, I can. All right,
Knock Knock.
Who's there?
Karen.
Karen? Karen who?
Karen, shut your big dog.
It must have dawned on Peter Sellers after that reception that these infantile characters were worth sticking with. At the time he recorded that, the goons were still an idea waiting to force its way into fulfillment. The material was already being stockpiled by Spike Milligan.
I saw it behind a bar in Westminster and London, and the chap who owned the pub, Jimmy Grafton, he was writing at the time odd scripts for a chap called Derek Roy, who was big shakes in those days, and I used to tell one or two jokes, and then bit by bit he said, do you know any jokes? I said, there's some more jokes. And then I'd run out of the jokes. And he said, well, did you only want to know? I said, make some up, I suppose. So I started to make up jokes for Derek Boyd through Jimmy Grafton. And bit by bit, I started writing scripts. And then I started to write way out things, which were constantly cut from the scripts. And I kept all these things on one side. And nobody ever used them, except when I met Peter Sellers. And then he laughed like mad at these jokes. I said, do you think they're funny? He said, yes. Well, that was praise enough at the time, because he was quite a big name in radio when that happened.
Milligan and Seacombe had met in the army in Italy. Milligan and Sellers were trying out material privately, and the fourth active goon was Michael Bentine.
We'd all known one another at the windmill, and we naturally gravitated. We've got the same sense of humour, so we gravitated together. If we were called the Junior Crazy Gang, it shows you how long ago it was.
The goon voices came from all over. Eccles, largely from Walt Disney's Goofy. Blue Bottle from the kind of kiddywink we've already heard. Gritpipe Finn from the standard George Sanders character, and so on. But their collective name?
The origin of the goons was in the 30s. The Popeye cartoons had characters that were big and hairy. They had rather thin biceps and very fat forearms, rather like Popeye, the same sort of drawing. And they were called goons. They lived on a goon island, I think. And they taught you Star Trek. They had a sort of and that was the goon. They were great big hairy twits. Then during the war, when there were Allied prisoners of war in Germany, they referred to the German guards as the goons because they were great big hairy breathless twins.
Finally accepted onto the airwaves in May 1951, over 2 years after they started pushing for a chance to appear together, they had to accept a billing as those crazy people. BBC senior management couldn't go along with this goon thing. In fact, at least one of them thought he was dealing with the Go On show. As far as we can tell from fragmentary glimpses of the first two series of Goons, Bentine was at least as prolific a supplier of ideas as Milligan. He certainly played one of the dominant character parts, as Roderick Pureheart, a mad inventor. Here he is in one of those rare and hairy-sounding shreds of early goondom.
Thank you. You know, Captain, that's possibly the strangest sounding excavator I've ever heard.
Excavator?
That was my wristwatch.
The Goons of 1952, and at last they were officially allowed the name they wanted in June of that year. It was still a magazine program rather than an interrupted narrative, so there was room for Harry Secombe to give them the operatic work. With sobs and not a giggle or a raspberry to be heard. Secombe was a busy man. He'd become one of the stream of young stars who rose simultaneously through the ranks of educating Archie.
Mr. Heddlesecombe, your trust will be travelling salesman. Oh, bringing you the new electric chimney sweeper. No more black hands, no more black faces, no more soot, and in many cases, no more chimneys.
Harold!
When I finish cleaning your chimney, it will be so clean you'll be able to eat your breakfast bit.
But Harold, your mouth and your hands said black.
My last client insisted I had breakfast in it. Silly fool. He got on the roof and lowered me down a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and then some bacon and eggs.
Oh, no.
Well, yes. All I can say is you're wearing a very small yellow beret.
Yeah. Yellow beret?
Yes, with bacon earplugs.
Oh. The fool, the absolute fool. Agatha, do you remember I was taking you out to lunch?
Yes, I did, yes.
Good. Well, I'll kneel down. You get a knife and fork. This is it.
No,
Agatha, please don't catch me like that. I didn't mean it. Say something nice to me, Agatha. Please don't stand there silent. Say something. I was ribbing you, Agatha. Please forgive me. Agatha, you can't leave me like this. Say something.
Bacon bomb.
Secombe with Archie and Hattie Jakes, later Bitmar, and Max Bygraves, too. It may seem unlikely now, but Bygraves at the time was consorting with at least two goons, because he was also a star of Paradise Street. The common link between all three shows, Goons, Archie, and Paradise Street, was the writer Eric Sykes, who worked on a similar wavelength to Milligan and his early partner, Larry Stevens. In this sequence from Paradise Street, you'll hear a perfectly recognisable Bygraves, Hattie Jakes again, and a strangulated Milligan impersonating a policeman, with some very Milligan-esque lines. Maybe he collaborated on them.
It's 11 o'clock. Mr. Foster is in bed now.
Yes, it is.
We must make good oil above all. I must dig silently.
How do you dig silently?
He's got a rubber shovel.
How will you know when Mr. Frogburton is asleep?
I'll find out.
Yes? Good night, Mr. Frogburton. Sleep well. Good night.
Even if he's asleep, won't he hear you digging from his bedroom window?
I'm not going to dig from his bedroom window.
Your boots can make an enough noise to waken the...
Don't say it. In any case, I'm wearing soft shoes.
Got your shovel?
Yes.
Well, do me a cross-shoe shovel.
Mr. Frogburton's hardly likely to sleep while he's being interrupted at 5-minute intervals.
But, dear silver lady, how else will we know when he's asleep?
We'll put a ladder to his bedroom window and have a look.
That'll be a good idea.
Even better than a catchphrase in which the audience has to participate. I remember shouting "Sun" myself when Bygraves came to Blackpool about that time. There was a good deal of the Goons' reversible logic at work in that material, and it was a form they were now on the way to perfecting. Michael Bentine had left the team in November 1952, but with Milligan now enjoying a greater confidence in himself as a performer, the three-man team was well able to carry on. By the fourth series, late in 1953, the Goon Show was sure enough of its storyline to carry a dramatic subtitle. The first, one of the long-lost Goon Shows, was called The Dreaded Piano Clubber.
Nobody about in the shop. Is there anybody in?
Yes, me.
Who are you?
Mr. Cran, I came in with you.
Bentine!
the ground as ever you and me.
Good, good, good. In any case, whoever works in this dreadful, filthy kennel shop must be right off his head.
I wonder who he is.
Hold on, boy. Do the horn. Hello,
good evening.
Good evening.
How are you on a bar shadow?
I'm looking for a criminal.
Oh, that's one mic I haven't got.
I wouldn't buy a piano with a hobble.
What? I kept a hobble? My shop a hobble? Oh, no, my man. This is a very elegant shop, this is. Famous men come here, my man. Famous men. So, do you know who comes here?
No.
Monsieur Paul de Groen.
Is he famous?
No, but he comes here.
From the dreaded piano clubber, starting as they meant to go on, since pianos, clubs, and dreaded items featured largely in Spike Milligan's overheated imagination throughout the rest of the 50s. But the goons were an acquired taste, and listeners would only acquire it gradually. The real devotees, young people of, say, the Prince of Wales's age, or a bit older, were too young as yet to catch on. Joining Just Fancy in the no-audience movement in the early 50s were the Canadian pairing of Bernard Braden and Barbara Kelly. They started out uncertainly in British radio, making at first the big mistake of reproducing the formulae of ITMAR in Leave Your Name and Number.
You realize, of course, that you're driving me into the arms of some rich, gorgeous dope of a girl.
Kelly! Mrs. Griffle.
Good morning, Griff. Good
morning, Jack.
If we knew you were coming, we'd have cleaned the place up a bit.
Oh, that's all right, dear. I can clean round the dirt.
Good.
Oh, my feet are killing me. It's the new shoes.
Too small for you?
No, my feet are too big for them.
Oh, sure.
Just like the old man.
Your husband complains about his feet?
Everybody complains about his feet, dear. First thing he does when he comes home from the works is to take off his boots and put on the television. I don't know which bothers me most.
I take it then you have some fault to find with the television programs, Mrs. G.
Oh, it ain't a program so much. It's our machine. Something wrong with it.
Something wrong?
Yes. Half the time the bloke that comes on grinning and says, this here's the BBC television service, is on upside down.
Upside down?
Yes, because the old man's too stingy to take it to be mended. Instead, he's built a trapeze in the sitting room and hangs there by his knees. Well, let's get on with me work.
Yes, it seems a shame to get that nice new mop all dirty scrubbing our horrid old floor.
Does, doesn't it? Well, I'll leave it until next week, then, shall I?
Huh?
Cheerio, bye.
Miriam Carlin making the very best of a recycled Mrs. Mop. They had a Colonel Chutney character, too. But with Breakfast with Braden and later Bedtime with Braden, they settled down into an intimate, no-audience format, playing off the suavity of announcer Ronald Kretcher, as several later shows would do, and being tickled at, just to remind listeners that laughter was not actually forbidden, by the band.
You may have heard of our school, one of the finest centers of education in the North, Old St. Ingrid's from the Foundry. We of the staff were proud of everything in it, except, well, we all knew that the most unpopular person in the school was the Latin master, Mr. Tuckhamper. How could he fail to see the intrigue that was rampant between myself and his bitterly pretty young wife, Gloria?
Now you're back, my dear.
Look, just as soon as I get in the door, don't you ever shut up.
Well,
I suppose you want to know where I've been, don't you? Well, I've started to gab at the lab with young Stinks, the handsome science master whom he has got all the girls for miles around in a whirl about him.
Yes, well...
Well, what? I don't know why you have to get so head up about every little thing I do. Oh, my head is spinning. I must have a migraine again.
Yes, dear, I'll fetch one for you. Dear me, Gloria's gone. Probably the bus ride back made her feel ill. Oh, yes, stick, transit, Gloria, and the doorbell will ring.
It is I, sir, your pupil, young Pabulum.
Come in, Pabulum, come in. Time for our lesson.
Our last lesson, I'm afraid, Mr. Tuckhamper, sir. The headmaster just declared you out of bounds.
So this is my reward for 15 years of continuous service at St. Ingrid's.
16 years, I believe, sir. You came here the year after I did.
So I did, sir.
Nobody cackled more loudly in that band than Charlie Capps. And years later, he earned his own show with his novelty sextet, where you can hear him cackling at himself. Bernard Braden credited the producer Pat Dixon with mobilizing Bedtime with Braden. And along with Dennis Mayne Wilson, Dixon had most to do with the promotion of the Goons from idea to reality. Producers are sometimes lucky. Shows fall into their laps almost ready-made. Others have to carve a satisfying program shape out of the living manure. Dixon, anyway, seems to have the knack of attracting programs that would, in the end, achieve a high-quality finish. One that gave him less trouble than most, I'd imagine, since it was largely devised by Peter Ustinov with the help of Muir and Norden, and featured Ustinov and Peter Jones as most of the cast of characters, was In All Directions. This was a show where you were more thankful than usual for the absence of an audience. Those half-mumbled subtleties, those little tones of voice, would have been lost on a stage.
Good morning. I saw your board outside saying the house is for sale. Are you the owner?
Yeah. No, you see, we're the agents. We believe in the personal contact, and we're always on the premises. Dudley.
Hello, yes.
He's putting me in the house.
No. Yes. Good morning, Mr.
Good morning.
What's the name?
Grosvenor. Dudley Grosvenor. My brother.
Yes, I was rather interested in the house. It's a very old house, isn't it? What period, would you say?
Well,
what periods are there?
The ceiling.
Where does this door here lead to?
Those are the usual offices. Nothing unusual about those offices.
Yes. What about the lease, gentlemen?
The lease is a 2 3/4 lease spread over 3 1/4 year.
And split. And you're a party war which you're entirely responsible for.
And it protects you against yourself.
That is a good thing.
If you don't mind, I'll just run upstairs and have a look over the...
Run for it.
Full of deft throwaways and overlapping dialogue, Ustinov and Jones in all directions as Murray and Dudley, with the bewildered client played, as you may have guessed, by Frank Muir himself. Muir and Norden, having got through the pain barrier that afflicts writers after several series of the same show, were now approaching the maturity of Take It From Here. With Jimmy Edwards, Dick Bentley, and at this stage Joy Nichols, they had hit upon the glums.
Take your dad on a honeymoon? Well, you know him and his remarks.
Now, don't cry, beloved. Look, we needn't all stay at the same hotel. We'll book a double room at one hotel and a single room at another.
Well, that might be possible.
Of course, yes. And Dad and I could meet you on the beach on the creek. Don't cry, beloved. You know it only makes me cry.
Hello. What's this, a meeting of the Johnny Ray fan club?
The Glums on their way in 1954. Peter Sellers in that year was still doing character voices for Razor Mars, but his goon range in the meantime had almost completely crystallized. The Goons, in fact, were soon well enough established to offer hospitality to the running characters of a previous comedy era, the one from which they themselves had recently escaped.
Wait a minute, sir. The Colonel is coming, starting on 3 Arsenal 2, Snow and High Ground.
The Colonel? Chain the brandy to the wall. I knew he'd put
a glass of port. I don't mind if I do.
By the great leather putties of Jemadar Goldstein.
Colonel Kinstep is you, sir.
Yes, sir. Colonel Kinstep is always me.
What a fortunate coincidence for you both.
Well, if you insist, then it's just a sort of...
What?
Enough? Oh, just a spot there.
Yes, yes.
Yes, have another?
Just a small one for me.
Yes, sure.
Spot more?
Oh, no, no. I think it's the first time you had one. Just a minute, there, boy.
Quiet, Hoffman!
Lost his goldfish.
Jack Train's Colonel Chinstrap unexpectedly bobbing up above the whiskey line again in the fully developed Goon Show. But in the still formative year of 54, with the Starlings, as we said, they nearly parted company with the BBC. Like Tony Hancock, whose swift rise we'll be following next time, Spike Milligan was not a man to draw a neat distinction between his comic self and his real-life concerns. So there was a lot of anger in his work. And the same anti-authoritarian feelings that produced characters like the military coward Bloodnock could be turned on other authorities too. The BBC was one, and no doubt would have been, even if Milligan hadn't already felt that the corporation was working him too hard and unsympathetically. At all events, a scene in which a very Richard Dimbleby-like commentator described a ceremonial appearance by the Duchess Boyle de Spudswell, a lady clearly not unrelated to the occupants of Buckingham Palace, did not please the powers that were. They hardly cleared up after the coronation yet, but they all got over it, and comedy did live to fight another day. We'll see you then.
And now she reaches the great gold and bronze microphone to make her declaration. But first, the master of the rose and leather goods pledges his allegiance, also the Quantum Honorum. So let us listen to it. He appears to be having trouble with the great microphone of state. The same great microphone used ever since 1672, hand-eaten and foot-slapped gold and silver, surmounted by two Burmese cherubs, and fashioned by the great sculptor Ben Venuto Cellini and his brother Fred.
Any resemblance to a Goon Show is due to the laxity of the producer, Peter East. Good night.
Russell Davis wrote and presented Radio Fun, and his producer is Neil Cargill. As we heard, next week they'll be tracing the rise of Tony Hancock, in addition to meeting the Huggets, and starting Life of the Lions.